All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio, and I am Jim Fossone, your officer of the deck today. It's my pleasure to bring you today's programs. We're going to have a very interesting discussion on gambling addiction and its relationship to your military service or that of a friend of yours. And then after that, we'll talk about the ethics of doping in the military. So kind of two interesting issues that we haven't talked about before on Veterans Radio, so I think you'll enjoy it. And we want to thank our sponsors here. First would be the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles K. S. Kettles Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, the American Legion Post 46, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423, and our friends at U.S. Wings for their continued support, as well as those at Legal Help for Veterans, who can be reached at 800-693-4800. But as I say, we're going to start talking with a VA doctor who deals with gambling addiction. Stay tuned. I think you're going to find it interesting.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Les Waite. Dr. Waite is a clinical psychologist at the VA, the Lewis Stokes Cleveland VA Medical Center. Dr. Waite, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's great to talk to you today.
Well, it's always great to have a subject matter expert on, and certainly somebody who is got a background that can relate to the military. Before we get into gambling disorders in the veteran population, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, sure. And my background goes even farther back than just me. I'm what they call a military brat, and when I was old enough, I joined the military myself and was in for 11 and a half years in the Ohio Air National Guard.
Tell us a little bit about your educational background and how you ended up in this field and with this particular niche.
Right. So that's a story in itself. I served during the first Gulf War. I was not deployed myself, though my unit was. And what I saw coming back, I saw a lot of people coming back with a whole bunch of issues. And the mental health services that were available to them at the time, especially. So I thought this was another way that I could continue serving. It was something else that I could do. I went back to school and got my master's and my doctorate in clinical psychology, with specializations in military psychology and substance use disorders at the time. And I've been working in the VA healthcare system for the past 5 years in substance use disorder treatment, the past 1 year in gambling treatment specifically.
Well, I think many folks understand the mental health issues and the substance abuse issues and how that fit together. But I was kind of surprised, and the reason we're having this discussion for our veteran radio audience is this idea that there was a maybe an elevation of gambling addiction among both active duty troops, which could pose national security issues, but also for veterans. And that it causes, other problems for them as well. Was this something that, as you were going through your educational and work experience at VA, you were seeing that gambling addiction as a piece of that mental health problem? How did that get, I guess, raised to your consciousness?
Well, over time, it did become more and more apparent that there was this weird thing called behavioral addiction that was happening in the veterans that I was treating for substance use disorders. A lot of them did have comorbid psychiatric disorders, but a few of them, every now and then, would have what was at the time considered an impulse control disorder, and it dealt with gambling. And I always thought that was curious. And with the advent of the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in 2013, finally recognizing behavioral addictions like gambling disorder, it became recognized as an official addiction, and so all of a sudden it became a focus of treatment. And once that happened, more and more research came about to determine the prevalence. And it turns out it's a lot more prevalent than we thought, and certainly in the veteran population, it's 2 to 4 times more prevalent than the civilian world. Veterans are at a higher risk for gambling disorder than most other folks.
It's a really surprising statistic. Is the research far enough advanced, Dr. Waite, to be able to say why that is?
Well, it's a cart before the horse kind of situation. There is no unifying theory behind what causes gambling disorder because it's subjective. It's different for different people. So what we see, the common theory, the most accepted theory right now is called the pathways model, Luzinski. His model, and that is for most people, gambling disorder develops based on just standard classical conditioning. I do something, I get a reward for it, I want to do more of it. For other folks, there's a vulnerability involved, and by vulnerability, I mean a mental health issue, a substance use disorder, something like that, that the gambling serves a purpose for. Let's take folks with PTSD, for example. The most common report that I get from the veterans that I treat with PTSD is that when they gamble, they go into like a bubble, a zone, and all of their symptoms fade away, which seems kind of oxymoronic. In a very loud casino where there's clanging slot machines and a whole lot of people and a lot of entrances and exits to keep your eye on, the PTSD folks calm down in that environment and find peace in front of the slot machine. And therefore, it assuages their symptoms. So guess what they do every time they start feeling symptoms ramp up? They go to the casino.
So this is sort of self-medication. We joke, joking is the wrong word, but we apply that term to veterans who may drink to self-medicate to take away the other symptoms. But there are at least some folks you're suggesting who may gamble to alleviate those symptoms.
Absolutely, and I'm using PTSD as an example, but it's applicable for depression, for anxiety disorders, for anything that creates problematic symptoms for somebody that they need relief from. Gambling, in a lot of ways, serves as that relief.
Is there a definition of gambling addiction? When you know, everybody can go to the casino and pull the slot machines and have a nice night out and enjoy that. What's the, I don't know if it's a clinical definition or professional definition of where you've crossed the line and become you've moved into a gambling addiction.
Right. So for a little bit of, I'll throw a few numbers at you. For the general population, about 80% of the population gambles recreationally and has no problem with it whatsoever. 15% don't gamble at all. And the remaining 5%, 4% are what we call problem gamblers, where they don't meet the full criteria for that diagnostic and statistical manual I mentioned a minute ago, and I'll get to that in a second. 1% are what we call people who have gambling disorder. They're gambling disordered, and they're the ones who really have crossed that threshold. And the threshold is determined by that DSM I spoke of a minute ago, and there are 9 criteria in that DSM that we take a look at people, and if they describe their gambling to us, we take a look at these criteria and see if they match them or not, and that determines the severity of their disorder. So, and it's all subjective as well. And when something, anything in general, becomes a disorder, that means that it's interfering with our life in very significant ways in very specific areas. Is it interfering with my relationships, my education, if I'm in school, my job, my general daily functioning? Am I preoccupied with it throughout the course of the day? Once these things start, the answer becomes yes, then we're leaning more towards a disorder.
And you've mentioned that the veteran population may have 2 to 4 times higher than the general population of folks with gambling disorder. I take it that's that 1% where it's really a problem. Is that also true in the active duty side, or is there something about getting out and being on the veteran side that seems to elevate this?
Well, this is more a matter of data collection. We have more information on veterans than we do on the active duty side, and there's a reason for that. The Department of Defense has a health-related behavior survey of their active duty folks and reserve components, actually. And they used to ask the question, or several questions, concerning gambling behavior throughout the 90s. Those questions were removed in 2002 by Congress and only were just last year reinstated. So we have a huge gap of over a decade of no data for the active duty folks.
Can you explain what the rationale, or was there a rationale, Congress's rationale for removing it in 02?
Well, it's kind of, again, this is a kind of a chicken and egg kind of situation. The DOD, they actually put out a publication that said that there's no evidence to suggest, in their opinion, that gambling disorder is a high prevalence disorder within the Department of Defense. So they considered it impractical to screen for a low prevalence disorder, so they got rid of the screening questions.
Okay, I can see the logic of how this sort of got circular. We won't look at it. We don't have a problem because there's no data to suggest it. Okay, I get it. That sounds like the military.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's.
And the Government Accountability Office in January 2017 said, well, the reason it's so low is because you're not screening for it. And that became the circular logic. And it was just recently that Senators Warren and Daines submitted a bill, legislation, to have that reinstated, and that was last year that it did actually become enacted. So.
Because there are reports in the general press that is, you know, 40 to 60,000 active duty troops may have a gambling disorder, and I don't know, to me that sounds like a big number.
Yeah, the our friends at the National Council of Problem Gambling, they estimate that 56,000 active duty folks meet criteria for a gambling disorder. That's pretty high. And I'll tell you, it's higher for, getting back to the veteran population real quick, it's 2 to 4 times higher for most veterans. For specifically Vietnam-era veterans, that's actually 10% of the veteran population has gambling disorder of that population. Significantly higher for veterans from the Vietnam era.
Again, I have to ask you the question, what's the research tell you as the reason why? Is there a reason why?
They think it's more the stressors that are involved with the folks coming back from the Vietnam conflict, the non-acceptance of the society when they came back, the very tumultuous relationship the veterans at the time had with the Veterans Healthcare Administration and VA care. They tend to have higher comorbid diagnoses, that population, than the more recent conflict veterans.
Could you talk a little bit about what comorbidity means in this context? That's a big word, and I can barely say it, let alone understand it. So can you explain it, Dr. Wade, in English for our veteran radio listeners?
Absolutely, yeah, and I'm sorry I kept using that word. So it just means having more than one issue to deal with at the time from a mental health perspective or an addictive perspective or both. So if I have... If I am addicted to nicotine and I have a diagnosis of depression, those two diagnoses are comorbid. They exist together alongside each other. And they often feed into each other. So the more diagnoses, the more mental health issues and addiction issues that someone has, the more complicated and complex their case is. And that informs treatment. We have to treat everything. We can't just set – somebody comes in for addiction treatment and they're depressed. We can't set the depression aside while we treat their addiction. They are related.
And if somebody comes in with a TBI or PTSD, do you look to see whether or not there's also an addictive behavior as it relates to gambling?
Every time, yes. That's part of our standard screening process. We don't just, here in the gambling treatment program at the Cleveland VA, we don't just screen for gambling disorder, even though that is our primary treatment. Why we're here, why we exist. We always screen for any kind of depression symptoms, any kind of anxiety symptoms, any kind of substance use disorder, as well as gambling disorder. Always.
We're talking to Dr. Les Wade of the Cleveland VA Medical Center. You mentioned that as many as 10% of the Vietnam veterans have a gambling addiction. What percentage of those folks actually will then receive treatment as a result of that diagnosis?
Yeah, across the board, it's estimated that only 10% of the population who have who meet criteria for a diagnosis of gambling disorder ever seek treatment. And certainly that number is higher in the Vietnam-era veteran population, and I attribute that primarily to a longstanding distrust of treatment and treatment providers in that population, understandably.
And Dr. Wade, based on your experience, is it that they never seek treatment because they don't acknowledge the problem. They don't believe it can be fixed. It's helping mask other symptoms, and therefore I really don't want to deal with those other things. I'm sure this is a really complex issue as to why treatment's not sought.
Yeah, and you're right. It's totally subjective, so it's every person has their own reasons for not seeking treatment. The primary thing that I've found, the fundamental aspect of that, is that the behavior is serving a purpose. So the gambling behavior for anyone is serving a purpose in some way. They're getting something out of it. And the very definition of addiction defines doing the same behavior over and over again, even though you know it's detrimental to your health. So people with gambling disorder know that they're going broke, that we have a high rate of homelessness as a result of gambling disorder in a lot of our folks. We have a high rate of legal issues when they resort to illegal acts to fund their gambling or to pay off their gambling debts. If you speak to these veterans face-to-face, as I do, logically they'll tell you, I know this is wrong. Excuse me, I know this is unhealthy for me, and yet they still do it. And that's the hallmark of addiction, doing the behavior over and over again, knowing that it's harming you, right? So the reason that typically happens is the behavior itself is serving some greater purpose for them. In other words, I'm not having anxiety symptoms when I'm gambling. So to me, that's worth it to gamble, even though I lost my house. I'd rather not have the anxiety symptoms, and I'm okay with losing my house.
Les,
I'm not okay with it, of course.
Les, you get to talk to the veterans who are working on their gambling addiction. You probably get to talk to their family members or spouses as well in some manner. Are they the ones who bring this forward often, or is it the veteran who steps forward and says, I got to get on this, or is it his spouse or her spouse who says, somebody's got to do something with this issue?
Right. Most of the cases I would say that I've seen in the gambling treatment program here are people who bring themselves into treatment, or they were referred to treatment by their mental health providers in other VA hospitals or in the community. That's the majority. We do have some people who come in of their own free will, but it's usually because their spouse says, I'm going to leave you if you don't get treatment, if you don't get help for this disorder. Something's going to happen. And very, very few, but a small number, do present because they're court-ordered for treatment. They've gotten into legal issues, and this is part of their court agreement, is to go into treatment, so they'll come here as well. We do work with the families in the gambling treatment program here at the Cleveland VA Medical Center. We can incorporate them into individual therapy treatment if the veteran chooses to have that. And we certainly, as part of our programming, later on in the five-week cohort that we have for inpatient residential treatment here, we have what's called a family call. So the family members can choose to dial in a conference bridge kind of situation and be part of a group therapy session with the veterans in the room.
I actually had not really thought much about gambling addiction as a problem for veterans, as I said at the outset, until I saw some of the recent articles, and which led me to you as a subject matter expert, Dr. Les Waite. And I'm thrilled to know that the Cleveland VA Medical Center has such a program. But can you talk a little bit about how that is across the country in the VA, whether it's other medical centers, whether it's CBACs, whether, you know, where else can people find this kind of treatment and support?
I'm actually heading up a study right now, and I'm contacting every VA medical center in the country to assess what kind of treatment opportunities they have for a veteran that they diagnose with gambling disorder. There is no other, unfortunately, residential program in the VA healthcare system except the one in Cleveland. And what we're trying to do is increase across the country the level of competence for the mental health providers who provide addiction treatment to get them training in how to treat people with gambling disorder, because it is a rather unique creature. We get referrals nationwide. We are a national program here in Cleveland. And that's historically been because nobody locally, where the veteran is located at the VA hospital, knows how to treat gambling disorder.
I'm going to have to back you up here.
Sure.
So if I'm a veteran in Texas or Florida or California or Virginia, you know, high population veteran states, and my mental health provider screens and says, yep, you've got a, you know, under the DSM-5, you've got a gambling addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other outpatient treatment program other than in Cleveland?
No, we are a residential program. We do have an outpatient program here, but we are a national residential program. So what happens is if you're in Texas, you're it used to be called the Veterans Choice Act, now it's the Mission Act. If the treatment is not available at your local VA and you are a veteran seeking treatment and that treatment's not there, you can be referred to your local community. So we can refer people to local communities for gambling treatment. That's an option for veterans today.
So Cleveland has the inpatient program, but I could get outpatient treatment at my Texas VA Medical Center, and if that wasn't sufficient or they didn't have the resources, they would, under the Mission Act, put me out into the local community for treatment. Do I have that right?
Yeah, if the veteran qualifies for Mission Act treatment, then yes, they'll be referred to a community provider who is certified to treat people with gambling disorder.
You've mentioned a very recent proposed legislation. Can you give us a sense of where you think that's going to go? Is there enough momentum in Congress to appropriate funding to see this roll out some?
Well, the two senators involved are very, very strong on this. It's actually a bipartisan program, which that's very encouraging. It's the Gambling Addiction Prevention Act of 2019, or the GAP Act. It's Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts and Steve Daines from Montana. And it's basically having the Department of Defense develop policies and programs to prevent, treat gambling before the service members discharge and become veterans. So they're trying to head it off at the pass with this legislation. So they're taking a look. That's more on the DOD side, though. So not only are they re-implementing the screening questions, they're actually increasing treatment programs in the active duty services, which historically have been few and far between.
Well, that's good news that somebody's paying attention to this and trying to increase attention, visibility, hopefully funding for treatment programs. As we come to a close, can you just briefly describe what the treatment is for somebody who's in or dealing with a gambling addiction?
Sure. So in what we want to focus on with people with gambling disorder, the signature, the hallmark characteristic are these what we call cognitive distortions, and they're just kind of twisted ways that we think about things. There's one famous example called the gambler's fallacy. And the gambler's fallacy kind of indicates that to the gambler that they have the ability to predict the outcome based on past performance. Take a roll of a dice, for example, or a flip of a coin. That one's easier. So everybody who has taken math class probably understands that if you flip a coin, it's a 50-50 chance of being heads or tails every time. Every time you flip it, it's a 50-50 chance. You start over every time you try to flip it. And what the gambler's fallacy does is it instills the belief in gamblers that because my five flips of my coin have been heads, 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 I believe that tails is due, so the next flip, the sixth flip, is going to be tails. Or, alternatively, I could believe that since the first five flips have been heads, that means that the sixth flip has to be heads. And I know this; they believe this is fact, and that's called the gambler's fallacy. The roulette wheel is a very similar example. If you go to a casino, you'll see these marquees above the roulette wheel that say the last six balls that have been struck have been red. And people will see that and say, well, it must be red next. Or because it's been red, it must be black next. And these are false. It's complete chance. The flip of the coin is a 50-50 chance every time you flip it. So the primary focus for treatment for people who come in with gambling disorder is to kind of take a look at these cognitions, these beliefs that they have. Some of them can even be superstitious, I treat bingo players who have an entire army of gnomes on their table, because theirs are the lucky gnomes, and if they scratch their heads before the number's called, they know that they're going to win. You know, it's these beliefs that they, and these are not jokes. These are actual firm beliefs that need kind of teased apart in order for the person to realize that, oh, this is just chance. I don't really have as much control over the gambling outcome that I think I do.
So, Dr. Les Waite of the Cleveland VA Medical Center, there is hope for treatment and, if you will, correction of the gambling disorder. If veterans have that situation, you're saying there is hope, there is treatment available.
There absolutely is. And when we are actually in treatment, individual or group therapy or residential treatment, we stick to cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been tried and true, shown to prove to work against gambling disorder and addiction in general. There are also medications that can help with impulsivity. And then group therapy. I cannot tell you the strength, the power that's found in getting a room together of people who have a similar problem and then getting them to talk about it. They learn to rely on each other very much, and they become their own support network, and that's the strength in a group type situation.
Well, we want to thank you for taking some time today, Dr. Les Waite of the Cleveland VA Medical Center. You're really a national expert on this gambling disorder issue in the veteran population, to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to be here today.
Told you that'd be interesting, and we have hope for those who have a gambling addiction that may be related to their military service. So stay tuned after the news. We're going to talk about a doping in the military and the ethical issues associated with that activity, and some really sci-fi insights into soldiers of the future, maybe, by genetic modification and drugs that could make super soldiers. Crazy stuff. Stick around.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
So this caught my attention, and I wanted to bring it to our veteran radio listeners. And so we're going to talk to Max Melman, a ethics professor at Case Western University, about research on the ethical issues of performance-enhancing drugs in use by the military.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a professor of law and bioethics, Max Melman. Max, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's give a little background for our veteran radio listeners. You are at Case Western Reserve Law School and Medical School, I believe?
Right. I have appointments in both schools here in Cleveland, Ohio.
Can you explain to the regular Joe out there kind of the reason or nature of this dual appointments? I think that probably surprised a lot of people about, like, what's that about?
Yes. So in 1953 at this law school, the first program was created to study the role of law in health, and became the field of health law. And in 1984, I was recruited from a law firm in Washington to take the program over after the founding director was retired. A great deal of the issues that are raised in health law involve ethical issues, you know, not just legal issues, and that's another field called bioethics. So I had to develop some expertise in both law and healthcare, medicine, science, and then also in bioethics. So that led to these twin appointments, although my primary role is as a law professor.
Well, and listeners, Max got his law degree or Juris Doctorate from Yale Law School. He did attend Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, and he did work at a very prestigious Washington, D.C. law firm. So while you've been in the academic role a long time, you bring a lot of those experiences to it. And it's sort of interesting. I saw somewhere where you said, boy, my career in life has just been a sequence of fortuitous events. You didn't set out to be a law and ethics expert, I don't think.
Well, I wanted, when I graduated from law school, I wanted to go into government service, you know, public service of some sort. And I was advised to start by joining a law firm, and that was in Washington, D.C. There were about 50,000 lawyers in Washington, D.C., and about 49,999 had the same idea. So I never quite got into government officially, although I've been involved as an advisor in a whole bunch of capacities since I became a law professor. And I stumbled into health law just by being in a partner's office one day when a drug company called and had a case they needed help on, and he needed a young person, you know, a junior person to work with him. I have no science background, no medical background. Actually, I do now because I was a ski patroller for 20 years, but a volunteer. But at that time, I didn't. So I had to learn how to learn all of this stuff. And over the years, I began to get research grants from NIH, for example. I developed some expertise in genetics and genomics. And in the course of doing some work there, an issue came up, you know, if we can fiddle with the human, you know, human genes to, you know, to fight off or prevent disease, how about, you know, fiddling with them to make, you know, more handsome or more powerful or more smarter humans? And so that led into some research on the field of biomedical enhancement, performance enhancement. That led into work on doping in sports. And that in turn led into work on the potential use of enhancement drugs and other, you know, techniques in the military context. And I had some grants from NIH to study that as well. And so, you know, I learned and I ended up writing a book about that some years ago called The Price of Perfection, not just about the military, but, you know, so all of those issues kind of came about. My understanding of them came about just by chance.
Well, it's a, you know, and this is a good lesson for everybody out there listening, that life is not a straight line, and seize whatever opportunity presents itself, because it may be a really interesting path that you weren't contemplating. So, and we run into a lot of people who have that experience. Certainly I do, and many others do. But the article that you wrote that caught my eye is called Doping Soldiers So That They Fight Better. Is It Ethical? And, you know, that, man, that really makes you start thinking about some stuff. And those of us who have been in the military quickly relate to experiences that we've had or others have had regarding, and we might not think about it in the terms of doping or performance-enhancing drugs, but we've all had those experiences where, whether it's all, just that one more cup of Joe or a go pill or some other thing. So when you began looking at this, tell us what you found about the long, rich history of trying to enhance the performance of military members.
To be sure, yeah. I mean, the word doping itself comes from an Afrikaner word for a substance that Zulu warriors swallowed before they went into combat, thinking that it would prevent them from getting bullets from actually being able to get inside them. So that goes back to the early 19th century. And, you know, we have had the experience in World War I and II of, certainly in the British Army, of, you know, having a tot of rum before you go over the top, which is a kind of a performance enhancer. You mentioned a cup of Joe, and you know, during the Civil War, the story is that one of the reasons that the Union won was that it had access to caffeine, actually instant coffee, if you can believe it, back then. And the South was blockaded, so they couldn't get coffee in, and they just weren't as alert. Once amphetamines began to be developed in the mid 1930s, speed, if you will. That caught on in the military, and you know, widespread use of that during World War II. The Germans, in particular, used a lot of it because they had actually invented some of it, and that the use of amphetamines, you know, has persisted. There have been some problems with it. You know, it can cause lapses in judgment and you know, nerves and things like that. So there was an incident in the war in Afghanistan where some pilots flying from Europe, their F-15s in a combat mission from Europe, accidentally bombed some Canadian soldiers thinking that they were getting a fire from the ground. And blamed their misjudgment, you know, the mistake on having had to take too many amphetamines to do that combat mission. And, you know, what the military is now very interested in is, you know, safer drugs and other techniques that are very effective, particularly at promoting alertness, because that's a big, you know, a game changer in combat. And also perhaps changing diet, for example, enabling soldiers to persist on to function well without sleep and without food, or at least without traditional forms of food. And so DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency at DOD, has been pursuing this for many years. And it's interesting to think about where the science will go, and with the new developments in genetics manipulation, gene editing and so on, there's possibilities there as well.
Well, it's again, when we, and this is right how society probably always moves along, it's sort of one little step at a time, and you look back and you can see this long connected trail that gets us to where we are or where we might be going as you start talking about changing the genetics of the warrior class. But how much thought have we put into what the ethical issues are when we manipulate our soldiers with performance-enhancing drugs?
Yeah, most of the thinking has – so some of the thinking has been, look, we don't want our athletes to use, steroids and other forms of doping, so why would we want, our troops to do that? One of my arguments is that they're completely different situations. I mean, what is the social advantage of an athlete, using, say, steroids, particularly if they're against the rules? Not much. I mean, right, the athlete gets to win, but society doesn't particularly benefit from that. But if a soldier can survive a combat without being injured, can complete the mission more safely and quicker and more effectively, there is an enormous social benefit to the individual soldier and also to the mission, and the country. So very different ethical contexts. A lot of the thinking, bioethical thinking, in terms of military use has been, what about giving soldiers drugs which haven't gone through the formal FDA approval process? A lot of drugs that are used to enhance performance, both in sports and just, people in daily life, are not approved for that purpose, right? I mean, they have medical purposes, but not enhancement purposes. So an interesting question that's come up, and it came up in the first and second Gulf Wars, is can we give, soldiers drugs that have not been, tested or fully tested or approved for the purpose we're giving it to them? Now, this originally didn't involve enhancement drugs. It involved vaccines against chemical and biological warfare, and then the anthrax vaccination program. But that question has arisen because most likely, if we do give troops performance enhancing drugs, let's stick with drugs, if you will, those drugs will not have been tested or not tested very much for those enhancement uses. And that's really a bigger problem, which is that we unfortunately don't have a lot of research on the enhancement uses of drugs like amphetamines and other sorts of things. It's a lot of people think it's unethical to test these kinds of drugs in people because, if it's in athletes, it's illegal. It's against the rules most of the time and so on. So one of the big problems, ethical problems in using these things in the military is that we don't have adequate knowledge of how safe and effective they are. And, we need to do research arguably before we start using these things. But then, of course, we've been using them for decades. So maybe we have sort of a natural experiment going on, and, we can look at how, people have fared, what health effects we can see. If we think, a lot of people must have been using these things, and what's happened to them?
Well, it's an interesting, there's all sorts of interesting little angles on this, because you talk about drugs for off-label purposes. That's one whole sort of, hey, I can get a boost out of this. This drug's not been tested for something else, but hasn't been tested for what it does to your heart rate or whatever it is. But it does that, so let's use it for that. That causes you to really look at it differently. And let's be honest, the Department of Defense doesn't have a great track record on medical experimentation, if you will, on its members. There are some very sad stories about particularly African American members and those who were subjected to radiation exposure to see what the fallout was and those sorts of things. So,
yeah, the doctor who just passed away who did the LSD experiments during the 50s and early 60s, for example.
So is that, how do you bridge the ethical morass here between those kind of experiments and the ones or the uses that you're referring to?
Well, so we can do, as I said, one thing we can do is a kind of a natural experiment. So, for example, let's talk about anabolic steroids. That's one of the primary drugs that's used by athletes to enhance performance. And there's no question that it works. I mean, you can see the track record in professional sports and the Olympics and so on. Has adverse effects? Well, we're not so sure, because there haven't been any long-term studies, any good long-term studies in healthy people who are using using anabolic steroids for to improve their physical performance. The military, we know that a number of soldiers do use them. We don't have exact details on how many or who, but one option is to invite those soldiers who do use them to come forward and admit it without any punishment, and just and follow them and see what health effects that has on them. Otherwise, we have to do what's called a randomized, controlled experiment. And if you think about the potential benefits of some of these drugs, I mean, think of, for example, modafinil. It's the brand name's Provigil, which increases alertness without as many side effects as amphetamines. That could be a game changer, to be able to stay awake and when you're on duty or you're on guard. And so it seems to me that it's ethical to try experiments and see how safe or unsafe these things are, and then go from there. One of the problems we've had with doing these sorts of things in the military is that we really haven't had a strong ethical framework for this kind of research in the military. Back in civilian life, we learned about the famous syphilis experiments at Tuskegee back in the early 70s, when a reporter broke the story, how African Americans starting in the 30s were diagnosed with syphilis and not treated even after penicillin and other things became available that were effective treatments, because they wanted to watch the progress of the disease. And there were another set of even worse experiments in Nicaragua on sexually transmitted disease. But anyway, that prompted Congress to basically say we need an ethical framework for doing research in humans. And so that led to something called the Belmont Report, which still is the foundation, the set of principles that we use in this country and spread around the world to determine whether an experiment is ethical or not. Those rules don't really work in the military. For example, one of the key principles in that Belmont civilian framework is autonomy. So, the person needs to be able to freely decide whether or not to participate in an experiment. Autonomy in the military is a very different thing than in civilian life, right? You have to follow orders, at least legal orders. So the idea of relying on individual soldiers to make you know, decisions on their own about whether or not to serve as research subjects really isn't appropriate for the military. So one of the things that I've done with some funding from NIH is to propose a framework for bioethics generally in the military and apply it to these kinds of research contexts. So when would it be ethical to get a group of soldiers together and say, okay, we want some of you to try drug X, think steroids, think amphetamines, whatever, and see if that, you know, see what the safety, how safe it is and what benefits it provides. You know, when would that, you know, what would, how would we decide that was ethical or not? And, you know, and I came up with a set of rules. The first one is proportionality, which is that, you know, the greater the potential benefit, the more ethical it is to try something. You know, you shouldn't give somebody something that's very dangerous if it's not going to help them much or if it's not for a very important mission. The second principle is paternalism, which is, you know, instead of relying on individual, you know, war fighters to protect themselves by refusing to do something that they think is dangerous, we have to rely on their commanders to make, you know, ethical decisions about when something is proportional or not. And then finally, fairness, which is, you know, sort of an afterthought in a way, and that is, you know, don't put people in experiments for, you know, unethical reasons, like, you know, they're slackers or something like that.
Again, I think it's so important that the Department of Defense have a strong ethical framework, and that really it may have to come, or maybe there needs to be a civilian oversight. Because not only performance-enhancing drugs, these same sort of ethical dilemmas exist, don't they, with some of the vaccines and other things that they say, well, we think this is going to be good for you because you might get exposed to anthrax or malaria or, you know, pick whatever foreign land we're sending you to and what their particular problem is. I think you have some of the same ethical issues, don't you?
You do. So interesting issue that's come up there is can we make a soldier use a drug, or do they have to give their consent? You know, do they have to volunteer to use something like that? And, you know, the problem was, you know, in the Gulf Wars, where we were afraid of, you know, the Iraqis using biochemical and biological warfare. So imagine a unit in which some members say, okay, I'll try it, and other members don't. And suppose, you know, the unit is subject to those forms of attack, and the people who did not volunteer, you know, who didn't give their consent, you know, aren't effective. They're injured. They have to be cared for, and so on. So, you know, the rules change. And so the real question is, how much evidence do you need of potential benefit and safety before it's ethical to give people something like that in the field without asking for their permission? You know, you all have to take, you know, botulism toxin vaccine and so on. And the rule now is, by the way, that that can only be done with the permission of the president.
We're talking to Professor Max Mellum from Case Western Reserve, who's the professor of law and bioethics and is the director of the Law and Medicine Center there. Does the analysis change from an ethical standpoint, Max, because this is a healthier population that's getting exposed to these things, or does it change because it's a population that has, you know, sworn itself into the military to follow orders?
I think both, but it's also important to realize that, you know, this is what we need our soldiers, our troops to do is something that's in the national interest. It's a service, it's other directed, and so we have to both take care of them, and we also have to do whatever we can ethically to give them the best chance of completing their mission safely and effectively.
Well, and I think all of that sort of does factor into the long chain of different types of drugs, vaccines, performance enhancing things, and now we're moving to, and I just want you to kind of close out with this because I kind of a whole new thing to think about is could one really modify a soldier's genes in some short-term way to make them stronger, better, more capable warriors?
Well, you know, we're just beginning to figure out if we can do that at all. So far as I know, there isn't that isn't being tested directly in the military. Our knowledge of genetics is still pretty much in its infancy. But there are, you know, there are genetic applications of performance enhancement. So, for example, there are drugs that athletes take to dope themselves that are made with a genetic technique called recombinant DNA. So we get bacteria to create a drug, performance-enhancing drugs that humans then take. Erythropoietin is a substance that we naturally produce, and it increases the number of red blood cells, which in turn increases the carriage of oxygen to the muscles and gives you more endurance and so forth. And we can give synthetic erythropoietin to people, and we can even install a little genetic factory in people that pumps the stuff out when your blood levels, you know, when your oxygen level drops a bit. So we're beginning to see the use of genetic related techniques. Another issue that I'm working on in a context with the Air Force is, you know, can we test members of the military for their, you know, genetic makeup, either when they seek to enlist or, you know, during their careers, and you know, because we're learning more and more about how our genes affect both our health and our performance. And, you know, would it be fair to say, I'm sorry, but you cannot be, you know, in the military, or you can't, you can be, you're going to be limited to certain roles in the military, ones that, for example, don't necessarily lead rapidly to advancement, because we've tested you and you don't have the best, you know, good genes for that. You know, you don't have wound recovery genes or alertness, you know, alertness or strength genes. So there are all kinds of ethical questions that we're facing really right now. With the ability to test people in terms of what their genes look like.
Wow.
As we learn, but that's, you know, that's just the beginning. And, you know, part of the problem is that many of the major enhancements that could be produced by genetic techniques would have to be done before you were born. Interesting thought, you know, families with a long military pedigree, a long military history, might they, you know, take advantage of that, so their, you know, their offspring had a better chance of, you know, getting into and succeeding in the military, surviving, if you will. So there are interesting things coming down the pike, but those things are still pretty much still science fiction.
Wow, Professor Melman, you've opened a whole nother can of worms there. The concept of genetic screening and whether or not, hey, you're not going to be a good pilot or you're not going to make a good recon guy because you've got this genetic trait that will ultimately manifest itself. Very, very interesting. And the idea that someone would say, well, you know, my family's always gone to West Point, and I want to make sure we always go to West Point, so we're going to do some genetic modifications. So, you know, we're the fastest and strongest and biggest. Wow, those really. I'm glad somebody's thinking about them because I hadn't thought about them before. It's a very interesting area, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it keeps me up nights. You know, the most important thing is the well-being of our people in the military, and, you know, we have to take this stuff very seriously, even if it's down the road.
Absolutely, and we have to think about it ahead of time. So I want to thank you, Professor Max Melman from Case Western, for talking to Veterans Radio today and giving us a look at ethical issues that maybe we haven't thought about before, both looking backwards, but now you've got me curious. We're going to talk again someday looking forward. Very interesting. Thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I suspect that that's some information that you haven't thought about before, about the ethical issues of doping or genetic testing to make better soldiers. So I hope you enjoyed that. I found it fascinating. We're here bringing you these kinds of stories because we think they're important.
We hope you find them educational, interesting, stimulating, maybe ticking you off too. That'd be okay. But we can only do this work with your continued support. We'd like you to go to veteransradio.net and give us story ideas, bring forth things that you'd like to hear us talk about. And certainly there is an opportunity there to hit the support button and provide some financial compensation to Veterans Radio so that we can stay on the air and bring you these stories, which we do every week, both in podcast form on Tuesdays and then here on the radio on Sunday. So we really appreciate that you're spending time with us. And Dale will be back next week with some fascinating stories. And until next time, you are dismissed.